Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, we are continuing now with the study of the Samaditti Sutta, the discourse on right view. This is Sutta number 9 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And we are in the section of the discourse in which Sariputta, the Venerable Sariputta, has been explaining the sequence of steps in the formula of dependent origination, paticca samuppada. And we have been taking these steps back one by one. The last time, for the sake of convenience, I reversed the explanation, the sequence of the explanation, and I went from the 6 sense bases up to contact, and from contact to feeling. And then we know that feeling is the condition for craving. So now we have to go back to the 6 sense bases and take its condition. Okay, we're on page 140. In paragraph 50, section 50, this is just a little bit of review. It says, what is the sixfold base, or more naturally, we could say the 6 sense bases? What is the origin of the 6 sense bases? What is the cessation of the 6 sense bases? And what is the way leading to the 6 cessation of the 6 sense bases? Okay, these are the 6 sense bases: the eye base, ear base, nose base, tongue base, body base, and mind base. Okay, then with the arising of mentality, materiality, this is nama-rupa, there is the arising of the sixfold base. With the cessation of mentality, materiality, there is the cessation of the sixfold base. And the way leading to the cessation of the sixfold base is the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, so now we have the 6 sense bases, and the 6 sense bases arise with the arising of nama-rupa, mentality, materiality, or we can also translate this expression as name and form. Okay, before we go into the explanation how name and form, mentality, materiality, is the condition for the 6 sense bases, let us come to the next section of the sutta, which gives the explanation of mentality, materiality. Okay, so after the Venerable Sariputta gave this explanation, then the monks expressed their appreciation in paragraph 52. And then they ask Venerable Sariputta if there is another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view who has arrived at this true Dhamma. Okay, so Venerable Sariputta says, there is And then he explains, when a noble disciple understands mentality, materiality, the origin of mentality, materiality, the cessation of, let me use the Pali, the cessation of nama-rupa, and the way leading to the cessation of nama-rupa, in that way he is one of right view, who has arrived at this true Dhamma. Okay, that is the brief teaching, the condensed teaching. Okay, now to open the path to the elaborate teaching, the Venerable Sariputta begins with the questions. What is mentality, materiality, nama-rupa? What is its origin? What is its cessation? What is the way leading to the cessation of mentality, materiality? Okay, before I go into this explanation, I should give a little background explanation of this term nama-rupa. Okay, this was a term that existed before the appearance of the Buddha. It's not a term that originated with the Buddha himself. It was already a term used by the Brahmins. It's used, occurs in the Upanishads, one of the basic philosophical texts of Brahmanism. Perhaps I think it even precedes the Upanishads. But as used in the Upanishads, this expression nama-rupa is a way of designating the entire phenomenal world. According to the teaching of the phenomenal world, according to the teaching of the Upanishads, the entire universe, a phenomenal world, is a manifestation, an expression of one reality, one spiritual reality, which is called Brahman. Brahman is the one universal reality, which in its essence is ever the same. But Brahman appears as differentiated into many, many different things. These are the differentiated phenomena of the world. And now this multiplicity of differentiated phenomena has two aspects. There is the aspect of what appears, that is form, and there is the way we perceive and conceive and designate what appears. What appears is called rupa, and the perceiving, conceiving, and designating of what appears is nama. And so when a person appears to me, say, Venerable Shinsheng, his form of the body that appears, that would be form. All the shape of the body, color, and so on. But then, when I perceive the form and then assign a name, Venerable Xinqing, that is name. Or apply to inanimate things. We have here an object. Let's take something a little more complex. Something here which is square-shaped, black, gray, and white. Okay, so the way that appears to me, okay, that is rupa. Then there comes the designation of it. If I had no idea of what it is, I just consider it a shaped object. Not quite a cube, what would you call this? Anyway, a strange shaped object. But since I know what it is, then there comes the designation, a recorder, an Arcos recorder. So that is the appearance, is rupa. The designation of it, that is nama. That is in the Brahminic philosophy. It's not really Hinduism, because Hinduism is a phenomena that comes later, much later than Buddhism. But this is the philosophy of the Upanishads that derives from the Vedas and the Upanishads. And it was current in the time of the Buddha, even though there's no, to my mind, there's no evidence that the Buddha had any kind of detailed knowledge of the Upanishads themselves. But these terms and expressions were part of the culture of the period. Okay, now the Buddha, as he did so often, took up or picked up this expression and gave it a meaning that was in conformity with his own philosophical teaching. And let us see how the Buddha assigned a meaning to nama rupa that accorded with his own system, his own teaching. We have the explanation right here, even though it's Venerable Sariputta who's speaking, but the actual explanation comes from other suttas spoken by the Buddha. Okay, so what is, now Venerable Sariputta is going to take the expression nama rupa and break it down into its two components, nama, name, or mentality, and form, or materiality. Okay, so first we have nama, mentality. What is nama? Feeling, perception, volition, contact, and attention. These are called mentality or name, nama. Before I come to them, I'll go on and take care of rupa. Okay, the four great elements and the material form derived from the four great elements, these are called materiality, matter, or form. So, this mentality and this materiality, you take the one, you take the other, join them together, and this is what is called mentality, materiality, or name and form. Okay, now this mentality and materiality are two major aspects of experience. Okay, first, now in the process of experiencing anything, cognizing anything, when we are to give anything a name, that is, to designate anything, to organize the mass of data that flow in through our senses, to organize it into an intelligible whole. There are a number of factors that are basic to every act of cognition. These factors that are basic to every act of cognition, these factors that are present in every act of cognition, these are the factors that make up nama. These are the factors that constitute nama, mentality, or name. Nama is not actually name in the sense of the name Bhikkhu Bodhi, the name Venerable Guoching, or any other name. But it is, these are the factors that are, you could say, that are essential, indispensable to the act of naming. And it is through the act of naming that we organize experience and render it intelligible, meaningful to ourselves. Okay, first out of these five basic components, so they've come in this order, but the most basic of these five, you might call it the starting point, is actually contact. Because what is contact? Contact is the coming together of consciousness with an object through a sense faculty. And so for any experience to take place at all, there has to be, for, let's say, for any particular experience to take place at all, there has to be a contact with that particular object that is to be the object of that particular experience. Let me repeat that. For any particular experience to take place at all, there has to be a contact with that particular object that is to be the object of that particular experience. So we can say that it is through contact that consciousness goes out through the door of the sense faculty and shakes hands with the object and says, "Hello, object, how are you today?" Or, look at that from a different angle, it is through contact that the object enters through the door of the sense faculty and shakes hands with consciousness and says, "Hello, consciousness, how are you today?" Would you like to buy a new car? Would you like to subscribe to this magazine? Okay, once contact has taken place, then through contact, the mind adverts to the object. That is, there is a turning of the mind to that object. That turning of the mind to the object is what is translated here as attention. The Pali word is manasikara, which here the word manasikara, literally it has the sense of making in the mind. Manasi, what case is it? What case? Locative, right, good. Now, this is a single noun which is formed by bringing together a locative case with another noun to make one noun. Okay, so manasikara is, you could say, doing in the mind, making in the mind. Well, maybe we could put it into better English by saying bringing to mind. Okay, and through the act of attention and conditioned by contact, there occur feeling, perception, and initially there'll be even a very slight volition as ways of experiencing the object. So, when I look at this object on the surface here, and I see it, I attend to it, then even though this object, I don't have any particular strong feelings about it, but there'll be some feeling. In this case, it will be a neutral feeling. The feeling will not be particularly prominent. There'll be some, in this case, perception will be more prominent, since I'm sort of grasping the features of the object, trying to size it up, figure out what it is. And there'll be some volition. In this case, the volition will be very, very slight, recessive, because if I don't know what it is, then I really don't know what to do with it. If it's an object that I'm going to use, for example, when I perceive the cup with the drink in it, then I have the intention to take a drink. Then the volitional component in that, even in the act of perceiving the cup, will be more prominent. And with each act of consciousness, each act of perception, perceiving the cup, the volition will become stronger and stronger until it's motivating me to lift my hand and take the cup. In which case the volition becomes the dominant factor out of these five. And so we have to recognize that these five are present in every occasion of experience. But on different occasions of experience, one or another will be more prominent. Sometimes feeling is more prominent, especially when we experience strong pleasure or strong pain. Sometimes perception is more prominent when we are intent on noting or observing the characteristics of things. Sometimes volition is more prominent when we are concerned with doing things, accomplishing things. But all five are always present. And those five together are the most important factors in conceiving, designating, organizing our world. Okay, this is mentality, or nama, name. Then we come to rupa, form, or materiality. Okay, what is materiality? The four great elements, or the four primary elements, and the material form derived from the four great elements. Okay, what are the four great elements? We call them, in the traditional language, they're called the earth element, the water element, the heat element, or fire element, and the air element. But these elements are explained as, or the use of these names is explained as metaphorical designations for what we might call different modes of matter, of materiality. So the earth element is a designation for the solid aspect of matter, the property of, you might call, of resistance, the ability of matter to resist compression, to occupy space. It's manifest as hardness, solidity. The water element represents the liquid aspect of, or the liquid manifestation of matter. And it also signifies, we might call, the cohesive property of matter, the tendency of matter, material particles, to bind together. Okay, the fire element represents the property of heat. Energy, we can call this energy, thermal energy. And the air element represents the property of distension and contraction. Or the property of motion. Okay, these are the four primary elements. Then there are said to be types of material form that are derived from the four great elements. What's interesting, in the suttas, or the Nikayas, never spell out, never enumerate what are the types of form derived from the great elements? But this is done in the Abhidhamma, the other great collection of Buddhist texts, and probably different Abhidhamma systems do it a little bit differently. In the Pali Abhidhamma of the Theravada school, some 24 types of derived matter enumerated. I'm not going to mention them all, since most of them are not important for our purposes. But the most important of these types of derived matter are the five types of sensitive matter that constitute the ayatanas, the sense bases. I spoke about these last week. I called them last week the pasada rupa, that is the sensitive types of matter. So that what we call the eye base is a particular type. It's not just the eyeball, but it's a particular type of matter located somewhere inside the eye, which is able to respond to light and to transform light, rays of light, into color and visible form. And similarly, there's an ear base. The nose base is what is able to respond to smells. Tongue base, what can respond to tastes. The body base is not the whole physical body, but the sensitive parts of the body that respond to tactile sensations. So those are five types of sensitive matter. Then there's said to be four types of the sense objects, the four sense objects. That is, visible form is a derived matter. It's not one of the primaries, but it appears based upon the primaries. Sound is another. Smell is another. Taste is another. Now, you might wonder, what about the tactile sensations? Why aren't they classified as a type of derived matter? And this might be a peculiarity of the Pali Abhidhamma. I don't know about the Abhidhamma Kosha system, but they say the tactile base actually consists of the primary elements themselves, three of the primary elements: the earth element, the heat element. The earth element, because we can touch and feel whether something is hard or soft. The heat element, because we can touch and feel whether something is hot or cold. And the motion element, because we can touch something and feel whether it is expanding or contracting. But I have to say, my big question, one day in my hermitage in Kandy, I went out, you know, it's a hot country and we hang the towel up on a line outside. I went outside to feel whether my towel was dry or not. And suddenly the thought came to me, hey, if the Abhidhamma is right, by touching my towel, I should not be able to tell whether it is wet or dry. Because I'm not supposed to be able to, the water element is not supposed to be an object of touch. Do you understand? It said that the water element you're supposed to know by inference, but it's not a direct object of touch. But here I am feeling the towel, and it's not a matter of feeling whether the towel is hot or cool. But there's a distinct tactile sensation of wetness. So anyway, that is besides the point. So, in the Theravada Abhidhamma, the wetness, or the water element, becomes an inferred type of secondary matter, derived matter. It's not a direct object of touch. Okay, another important type of derived matter is called the life faculty. This is the faculty which is present whenever we're alive. And when that is cut off, it means blup, dead. Okay, so taking these primary types of matter and secondary types of matter or derived matter, putting them together, they're all called materiality or form. And then taking this mentality or name and this materiality or form, putting them together, and we get name and form. And now, maybe I should just ask if there's any questions. I want to come to the explanation of how name and form and nama rupa is the condition for the six sense bases. But before I get into that, I'll just ask, are there any questions on the explanation of name and form, nama rupa?
Does it imply that non-sentient beings don't have name and form?
A good question. Non-sentient beings are form, have form. Let's say a non-sentient being would consist of the four primary elements, and they would have various types of the derived matter. They would have, of course, they have color. They have non-sentient beings, non-sentient objects. Okay, non-sentient objects would have color. They will have smell. They will have taste, and they will make, some of them make sounds. If the wind blows through something like a bamboo, well, bamboo is alive, but through the shade of a window, it will make a sound. Yeah, so it's just form. There's no mentality, no perception, no feeling.
In Mahayana Sutta, the Buddha gave another meaning of nama and rupa.
I don't think he gave another.
Consciousness depends on nama and rupa, and rupa and nama and rupa depends on consciousness.
Yeah. But I didn't. Yeah.
Then the Buddha goes on to say, suppose it is during the time of conception. So this kind of nama and rupa, it seems to me, is not the definition.
Okay. Yeah, that's an important point. Yeah, an important point almost that I overlooked, and that is the primary reference here to of nama. It's not so much external objects as having the form, but it is the form of our own body. So what's meant by the rupa, primarily the internal form. So it's the form of our own body, the own body consisting of the four primary elements, so that the body having its hardness or softness, the flowing parts, the liquid element, the bodily heat, and then the contraction and expansion through processes like breathing, the flowing of the airs through the body, and then the color, scent, taste, and the sense faculties of the body. Yeah, so it is primarily these cognitive faculties like feeling, perception, volition, and the body. But rupa will also cover external matter as well. It's not a different definition, but it's just that I overlooked to mention that the rupa is that nama rupa is primarily referring to the individual considered as a material body consisting of the four elements and derived matter, together with the functioning of these mental components. Okay, any further questions? Okay, then let us go back now, backtrack to paragraph number 50, just where it says there are these six bases, eye base to mind base, and with the arising of mentality, materiality, there is the arising of the sixfold base. Okay, now this can be understood in two ways, at least two ways. And these two ways are not mutually exclusive. It's just a slight difference in point of view. One, let us see a general name for this. We might call it a developmental point of view, and the other we might call, we call it a analytical point of view. Okay, from the developmental point of view, here nama rupa, name and form, will designate the psychophysical organism, the mental and bodily organism that has taken conception in the mother's womb, in the case of a human or animal birth, mammalian birth, and is starting to develop. And as that psychophysical organism develops, the six faculties will emerge. Okay, now, when we take this developmental point of view, taking a human birth, we come to the moment of conception. The moment of conception begins when consciousness, a consciousness, a stream of consciousness coming from a previous life, links up to with a fertilized ovum. And that is the moment of conception, when a new being actually is conceived. And once consciousness links up with that fertilized ovum, then we speak about that as, we call it the manifestation or appearance of name and form, or name and form taking shape in the mother's womb. And what happens at that moment of conception along with consciousness? When consciousness links up with the fertilized ovum, that ovum, the physical ovum, becomes the body of the being that is to be born. And that body then is the rupa in the nama-rupa complex. And that fertilized ovum will then consist of the four great elements, and it will have certain types of derived matter. Of course, it will have color, it will have some scent or odor, it will have a taste, it will have the life faculty. And it will also have one of the six sense bases. Which of these six sense bases will it have? Which of these five physical sense bases will it have? One of them it has. This is the fertilized ovum at the moment of conception. Wait, one of the five physical sense bases.
Tactile
is an object. But you're close. What is that? It's the body base. The kayayatana, the body base. Of course, that little one-celled organism, now dividing maybe two, four cells, it has the body base so that it is sensitive to sensations. And at the moment of conception, when consciousness descends, along with consciousness comes feeling, perception, volition, contact, attention. Believe it or not, all of those five factors are present right at that first moment of consciousness. Their functioning would be extremely simple. So simple that we can't even conceive what it's like. Just as we can't conceive what will be the experience of a one-celled organism. But there is some feeling, some perception, some volition, some attention, all based upon some contact. And so that is nama. Okay, and then as the organism goes on developing over the weeks, I don't know, the time scale, weeks and months, there will, and the cells start to differentiate, then there will appear the organism divides, you could see the head emerging, the limbs. Then from the head, as the head cells differentiate, there come the certain cells receptive to light. Those become the eyes. Certain cells receptive to sounds. Those become the ears. Certain cells receptive to smells. That becomes the taste, the nose base. Certain cells receptive to taste. That will be the tongue base. So those are the other four physical sense bases developing. Based upon the original rupa at conception. Then at conception, that consciousness that descends, that becomes the mind base. The first, that very simple stream of consciousness, that becomes the mind base. And out of that stream of consciousness, there will emerge some acts of full consciousness, even of a very simple kind. So for this reason, that underlying stream of consciousness is the mind base. And so in this way, we say that with the arising of nama-rupa, there is the arising of the sixfold base. And if nama rupa is cut off, say in the mother's womb, if it doesn't develop, then there is the cessation of the sixfold base. The six bases don't develop. Okay, that's one way to understand this. This is what I call the developmental way. The other way, what I call the analytical way, is by taking any experience and we see that mentality, materiality is a condition for the six sense bases on any occasion of experience. For example, right now, say, for my eye to function as an eye, not just the mass of matter, what is necessary? When I speak about my eye base, then I'm referring to that subtle matter, the sensitive matter. For that eye base to function, it needs the support of the other types of matter. So it needs the other types of rupa. For the ear to function, for the ear base to function as an ear base, to be able to hear sounds, it needs the support of the other types of rupa. It needs the support of the four elements. It needs the life faculty. And so all five of the physical sense bases need the support of the other types of rupa. the four elements, and so on. And in rather complex ways, which you can figure out through reflection, even for the sense bases to function as sense bases, they need some contribution from the mental aspect. There should be, it's really the working of perception, feeling, contact, and so on, enables the sense bases to continue to function as sense bases. And then in human life, the mind base, this underlying stream of mind, of consciousness, depends upon mentality, materiality. The mind base needs the body, this rupa, this material body. And the mind base, that stream of consciousness, depends upon the factors that constitute mentality. The mind base, that stream of consciousness, doesn't function alone, but the consciousness always arises together with feeling, perception, volition, contact, and attention. Maybe I'll go through this again next week. The kind of review. Now it's come to 8 o'clock. I know this is rather dense, and I don't want to just rush it, pack it in too quickly. And I want to leave time to for people to ask questions, if anyone has questions.
When we speak about six sense bases,
yeah,
the former five, six, former five sense bases are much more in material.
Yeah, they are material. Yeah, yeah.
But in the sixth, the mind base, is it material or spiritual?
Yeah, this a good question. The sixth base, the mind base, is not a physical organ that supports consciousness. Rather, the sixth base, the mind base, is the underlying stream of consciousness from which active consciousness arises. So it is called also the mind door. It's sort of this is a metaphorical image of the stream of consciousness as a door through which active states of consciousness arise to perform active acts of cognition, to perform acts of cognition. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. To manifest acts of consciousness. So we have this sort of underlying flow of consciousness, which is occurring many, many times in the course of the day, even when we're active, when we're sitting here like this, when I'm sitting here talking. It seems like I'm just continuously talking and continuously conscious, but at the microscopic level, what is happening is that the mind is going into the state of, we call it bhavanga, of the stream of consciousness, coming out, dropping in, coming out, and it's just going back and forth so quickly that we're not aware of it. As one lies down to go to sleep, the mind goes into that bhavanga state more often, sometimes comes out for dreams, then goes in, until when it goes very deeply into the Bhavanga, then one has a long period of dreamless sleep. And now in ordinary waking consciousness, when we go into this Bhavanga state, the underlying stream of consciousness, that is the mind door, or that is the mind base from which the act of consciousness emerges to perform acts of cognition, acts of knowing, acts of experiencing. Suki.
I hear many, many times stream of consciousness. That phrase, stream of consciousness, is it in the sutta?
Okay, she's asking whether the expression stream of consciousness is in the suttas. The expression does occur occasionally in the suttas. I recall the expression vijnana sota, stream of consciousness. It doesn't occur that often in the suttas. But we do have a statement that the citta is changing very, very rapidly, that mind arises and ceases uninterruptedly day and night. Such expressions we do have. But the expression stream of consciousness, vijnana, sota, or citta santana, continuity of consciousness, becomes more common in the commentaries. Because they go into they treat consciousness in a more analytical way.
Fertilization take place even just biologically without the stream of consciousness.
Can an act of fertilization take place biologically without the stream of consciousness being involved? And would a living being then arise from that act of fertilization? That is the question. The question I'm asking.
Oh, well, what I'm asking is yes, suppose that a living being arises. I'm thinking of contemporary technology of cloning and in vitro fertilization. And if every merging of gametes summons the stream of consciousness because of undischarged karma, and these technologies interrupt that, and that could be karmically very have consequences for the technician.
Okay, in the case of in vitro fertilization, okay, even though the fertilization takes place in vitro rather than in the womb, but in such a case, since there is fertilization, a being has been conceived in this case, one would have to say that the stream of consciousness has entered, a stream of consciousness carrying its own karmic imprints from the past. Okay, the case of cloning, I have to admit I get into some difficulties how to bring this together with the karma theory. I would just have to say that it's not really more difficult than the idea of identical twins in principle. Just here you have two beings with biologically the same physical constitution, but one would just say that each one has its own stream of consciousness, which is part of a continuum which is passed on from or arriving from different beings from different series of beings through a different series of past lives. So one would assume that there's been some connection between these streams of consciousness and past lives, and that they've been very close together, which accounts for the fact that they've come together in physical organisms with identical genetic constitutions.
As far as the mind object as the with the mind, since it is a sense in Buddhism, I can't understand that, like when you achieve jhanas, why you're supposed to be free of the sense pleasures, but the mind is still involved, if the mind is considered a sense state.
I don't see the problem here. The mind is able to function without dependence upon the physical senses. Doesn't seem to be any more of a problem than why one can go to sleep when one is in a sleep, the dreamless sleep.
So there is like a separation between the five senses and the six senses of the mind.
Yeah, that is very possible, yeah. It's just that in sleep, the mind is going below the level of ordinary sense function, whereas in the development of jhana, then one is moving the mind above and away from the sense functions. Any further questions? Okay, then we all go into this a little more, and then we come to further aspects of it when we get into nama-rupa connecting to consciousness. So we're not yet finished with this, but next week I really want to finish the dependent origination and the end of the sutta. Okay, so we'll end the session by sharing the merits with the devas, the nagas or dragon spirits, the buddhas, and all other beings, requesting them to protect the Buddha's teaching, to protect the exposition of the teaching, to protect ourselves and others, and to achieve the fulfillment of all good wishes. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva Chirang rakantu desanam akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mangparang etavata cham hehi sampadang punya sampadang Sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cham hehi sampadang punya sampadang Sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.